This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Whether you are old enough to remember watching The Twilight Zone with that iconic opening, or on the black and white TV television set in your living room, or you have discovered it in reruns, Rod Serling's masterpiece put a stake in the ground for TV's ability to deliver great drama. We are joined today by the author of Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination, Nicholas Parisi, and WVXU local media reporter John Kieswetter. I can personally attest to John's longstanding interest in Rod Serling. To join our conversation, call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Nick and John, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's really great to be with you.
Glad to be here.
Nick, the foreword of the book, Rod Serling's daughter wrote the foreword, and she begins with what seems like the critical point. My father was a storyteller. What was, you know, television was in its infancy when he was getting started. What drew Serling to TV to tell his stories rather than to the stage or to other places?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, well, what drew him originally, he was originally drawn to radio, really, because radio was the only game in town, so to speak, when he first started in, the late 40s. But he was a forward thinker. And when TV started to emerge, he became interested in it. He saw the potential in it immediately. And he saw that as, a vehicle to tell his stories to the most, the biggest audience of people. So that's really what drew him. But he was, like most kids of his generation, he grew up listening to radio dramas, and he loved that style of storytelling. And so when he originally started sending things out, he shopped his scripts to radio and then just gradually moved into television kind of as a natural progression.
John, one of the things I think that comes through in reading Nick's book is the incredible transformation of local television programming from those first 15 years to what it is today. And if people don't understand sort of the basic difference in the structure, it's hard to appreciate how Serling got his start here.
Everything you saw on TV was local. I mean, it was rare to have something from a network, NBC here on WLW, and syndication, a couple, Sea Hunt and Highway Patrol, but everything was local. And to Nick's point, so Serling graduates from Antioch, comes here in 1950. This is the birthplace of all this great local TV that Crosley was going to do. And Serling ended up having to go across town to Taft's WKRC to do his drama because Crosley people wanted him to write patter for variety shows and travelogues and sitcoms and everything but the serious drama that burned in his heart.
There was no place at LW for serious drama. So he goes across to KRC, literally across town, there he begins to do several things, but one of them is called The Storm. And only one of those segments of The Storm has survived. It's a kinescope, a film right off the TV screen. Let's listen to that opening.
This is the storm. Nature raging with wind and rain and destruction. This is the storm that sends rain to sting man's cheek as a reminder that nature is impatient with the storms he creates in his mind, his petty battles on the earth.
Nick, the storm was really a sort of a testing ground for a lot of things for Rod Serling. How do you look back, and how did he understand the work that he did while he was here in Cincinnati?
Well, yeah, the Storm absolutely was a testing ground. Not only that, but it was also a venue for a lot of the scripts that had been rejected on radio, honestly. Well, actually, it was kind of simultaneously. Everything that he wrote for the Storm, he shopped to national series as well pretty much at the same time, and most of them were rejected or eventually would be produced on national series, but were produced on the Storm. So he saw it as he did see it as a developmental period. The funny thing that I mentioned in the book, I explored this, is that in later years, Rod Serling almost never mentioned the Storm. He almost never mentioned the work that he did on the Storm. He never mentioned Bob Huber, who was in charge of the Storm. He was the producer and director of the series, and it wasn't due to any bad blood, I, at least as far as my research could uncover. But the interesting thing was, I mean, in every essay that Serling wrote about his career, he always left out the Storm. And the point I make in the book is that I think he saw it as, you know, something that he, I mean, he wasn't proud of it. Let's put it that way. He saw it as his infancy. He saw it as his developmental period, and he kind of didn't want people to really know what he had to do to become the, you know, the writer that he eventually became.
John, we were talking about this the other day. The original studios of WKRC weren't exactly lavish in terms of what you could do in terms of production.
It was in the TimeStar newspaper building over on the 8th and Broadway.
And top two stories.
So it probably had a 7-foot, 8-foot ceiling at best. You had to have the lights up there. I mean, No Gods to Serve was, I think, basically, was it in a basement or a foxhole?
It was.
And
basement.
Know, there wasn't much outside, and there wasn't big, huge, elaborate sets that they could do.
Yeah, that particular installment of The Storm was called No Gods to Serve, and it was focused on people in war. And Nick, the importance of war as a image for Serling is really very powerful and influential, and really sort of trickles down through his work for years. He was a veteran of World War II.
He sure was, yes, and the war was what pushed him into writing to begin with. He admitted that he looked to writing as a form of therapy initially. He got into it to get these feelings, the trauma of combat out of his gut and get it onto the page to write about it. And the war influenced him as a man and as a writer for the rest of his life. And he revisited it constantly in his work, you know, in The Twilight Zone, out of The Twilight Zone, and as early as you said, 1951, we're talking about, No Gods to Serve, or 52. So yeah, it was there. And John's right, you know, those, the low ceilings, I mean, he was working with the materials he had, so he set this story in a basement, and, you know, so all the soldiers are kind of laying on the ground, and they're, you know, there's a wounded chaplain who was obviously laying on the ground, and, you know, because they didn't want to stand up. I mean, the ceilings and the lights were so low. So yeah, he worked with what he could, you know. I mean, there's another episode of The Storm that deals with a mine cave-in, and they're trapped in a mine at the, you know, so same thing, you know. So so he was smart enough to, you know, work with the tools he had.
And Nick, even though he didn't talk a lot about the Storm later on, he certainly used the ideas, the concepts that he did here, and extrapolated on them to become, you know, Requiem for a Heavyweight or Mr. Finchley versus a Bomb, some other longer pieces that he did later on Network.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, I mean, some of them were pretty much transplanted almost identically to Network eventually. So, yeah, so I didn't mean that he wasn't necessarily proud of the scripts themselves, but just that period in his life. As, you know, I quote in the book Mark DeWidziak, a friend of ours, a writer in Cleveland. He says, you know, the Cincinnati and WKRC was kind of like the place where stand-up comedians go to get their kinks out, to find out what's bad, you know, to find out what works and what doesn't work, and then they kind of move along to something else. And that's kind of what Cincinnati was for Serling. He was able to go somewhere off the beaten track, so to speak, and get, you know, get some of these kinks out and then move on. But yeah, at least a dozen of the Storm's episodes were eventually remade on Network series later on.
One of the things that you quote, Nick, in several chapters of the book in different ways is his application to Antioch. And I found it fascinating. When it came to World War II, he said, you know, he was one of the 11 million other guys who came back from that war who had very special problems that we were going to write about. And we, you know, that he was very clear, even as a vet coming back, that that's one of the things that was on his mind in his college application.
Yes. And in fact, that college application, that's one of my, you know, I'm very happy to have found that, because a lot of the quotes that from that were I hadn't seen in other publications. So I was very happy to find some of that, because, you know, I'd always known that Sterling came back like any combat veteran. He came back scarred. You know, he came back with almost certainly PTSD. He had the symptoms of it for the rest of his life. But I don't think I ever really truly understood the magnitude of it until I read that college application where he says how when he first came back, he was just – he didn't want to do anything with his life. I mean, there was a couple of months there after he came back where he just didn't want to do – he said the war pretty much eliminated any ability for me to better myself. He was – that's how despondent he was. And I didn't really realize that until having read that application. And then – yeah, and then from there, it's just – yeah, it comes up again and again throughout his career.
Nick, you have a chapter entitled Sterling's Obsolete Men Who Have This Feeling of Obsolescence. And you reference all sorts of people from Lefty O'Bannon and boxer Danny Fales and Harlan Mountain McClintock in Requiem for a Heavyweight. What was he working with there? Well, your argument is that he has a very clear view of a type of man.
Yeah, I think the war had a part in that as well. I mean, he saw, you know, his buddies, die early, young, die young. And that, you know, affected him as it would affect anybody. And he saw, you know, this he was interested in this idea of, you know, of people having a job, let's say a boxer or a soldier, whatever it may be. And then, you know, not being able to complete, you know, to move past that. And, you know, obviously death is the ultimate, you know, blockage to moving past that, you know. But so with these obsolete men, they came up, you know, in the Twilight Zone, you had Martin Sloan, the executive who just feels like he can't contribute anything to society anymore. You had, you know, boxer Mountain McClintock, who's done being a boxer and can't contribute to society. So when a soldier comes back and tries to become acclimated to society again, there's got to be that thought in their mind, like, what am I now? Well, I was a soldier. What am I now? What can I contribute? How can I become something more? And that, you know, that idea he transplanted into business executives, into athletes, into all sorts of different people in different venues.
Well, we're going to have to take a break. But one thing I want to point out is, at least I couldn't find it, a companion chapter on his views about women. But we'll talk about that and other things. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Rod Serling was a writer with tremendous power and range. If you only know Twilight Zone, you only know a small slice of Serling. Night Gallery was the opening that you're hearing under this, was just one more of his creation. To explore the life and career of Rod Serling, we are joined today by the author of a new biography, Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination, Nicholas Parisi, and WVXU local media reporter John Kieswetter. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. One of the things that's happened here, Nick, that I wanted to just and John tell you about is we sort of ask staff about their favorites. So our station manager said that it was – and it, this is about the Twilight Zone – Time Enough to Last. One of our reporters said To Serve Man. So – maybe I can ask you, Nick, after all of this, what is it that you came away with a piece that you just think is the one that grabs you and you find that you can keep discovering things in?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it depends if we're talking about the Twilight Zone. I think that, you know, I came away with, you know, my favorite episode of The Twilight Zone at this moment, and this might change tomorrow, you know, but right now it's one called Walking Distance. It's kind of Rod Serling's meditation on going back in time and going back to his childhood and rediscovering his innocence of the innocence of Binghamton and growing up in that small town and before the war, you know, going back to a time before that trauma occurred. So that's that. As the older I get, the more I relate to that particular one. But, you know, and outside of The Twilight Zone, one of the nice things was, you know, I did watch everything that exists in some format. I was able to watch, and there were a couple that I came across that, you know, that people aren't aware of that are just tremendous. One is called The Rank and File. It's an episode of Playhouse 90. You've mentioned Requiem for Heavyweight a couple times. You know, that's a Playhouse 90 episode that everybody knows. The Rank and File has never been released anywhere. It's about a union worker who makes the rise from the rank and file to become the president of the union, and it stars Van Heflin in a tremendous performance, and it's such a powerful piece that I was coming across pieces like this that I just wish people knew about, because it's really an amazing piece of work.
John, what about you?
I'll go Christmas on you. I say The Night of the Meek with Art Carney, where Art Carney finds this magical bag. He's a Santa, and he's an alcoholic Santa. He gets fired by the department store. He comes out on the street, finds this magical bag, and whatever somebody asks for, he could reach in and give it to him. And I just really enjoyed that one.
The spirit of Christmas.
But Dick, being born on Christmas, he wrote an awful lot about Christmas, and he was Jewish, right?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things. Yeah, he was born into a Jewish family. The Serlings were a Jewish family, but they were kind of, they were Reformed Jewish, and they were a little bit casual about it. I mean, Rod was not bar mitzvahed. They did not go to synagogue particularly often, but he was born on Christmas, and they celebrated Christmas, and they celebrated it more as a social thing, you know, just something to do as Americans. You know, they celebrated Christmas, and yes, he wrote about Christmas a lot, throughout his career. And The Night of the Meek is one time where he really let his sentiments about the holiday really, he wore them on his sleeve.
Well, you know, he might have written about Christmas a lot, but he also wrote about some really hard-hitting things and that were happening in the society. The lynching of Emmett Till really had a great impact on him. How did, when he's getting started especially, this was the era of McCarthy, how did he interact with both advertisers and censors, Nick, on getting things on the air?
Well, that is a big can of worms, you know. That really is, you know, when he first, you know, his first scripts came out in 1950, and that's essentially when McCarthyism became a term, you know, in 1950. So in that early part of Serling's career, he really wasn't writing anything that was all that controversial that was going to get, you know, on McCarthy's radar, you know, so he didn't have to deal with it directly. But as his prestige grew, and as his name, you know, recognition grew, he did want to address these more controversial issues, and he constantly got blocked by the sponsors who did not want to be associated with anything that might reflect negatively on their particular product. So that Emmett Till issue was a big one for him. I mean, the Emmett Till incident just destroyed Serling, and it was something that, as an artist, he felt obligated to write something about it. He knew he wasn't going to write the Emmett Till story literally as a documentary or something, but he wanted to dramatize that idea of how something like this could happen in some way. And when he did try, he did a lot of self-censorship, which I bring out in the book. I mean, he knew right. that certain things were not going to get by, so he did that. He self-censored, but then he was additionally censored by the sponsors and the networks as well.
Yeah, at one point you quote Serling as saying, "You literally were damn frightened to put your name on a script, and for fear that the House Un-American Activities Committee or McCarthy's committee were going to come after you." And it just sort of it put a lid on the creative process. And I think that section of your book is really kind of fascinating. Let's talk a little bit more about, you know, everybody knows Twilight Zone. And here in Cincinnati, that's why we started with The Storm, because it happened here. But one of the goals of your book is not to have Serling just known for The Twilight Zone. Talk about him as a writer, a creative force beyond The Twilight Zone.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that, Dan, because that's, you know, if there is a point to my book, that's it. That Rod Serling was more than The Twilight Zone. I mean, this is a guy who wrote over 250 scripts that were produced on television or in feature films, and 92 of them were Twilight Zone episodes. So you got, you know, well over 100 other things that Rod Serling had written, and he wrote some great stuff. And the other thing that was kind of a point in my book was that if you read other publications, it's very easy to get the idea that Rod Serling he peaked with The Twilight Zone, and then it was a steady decline afterward. And in looking through his work, I did not see it that way at all. There's plenty of great stuff afterward. You mentioned Night Gallery. He had a very contentious relationship with that particular series, but he wrote some great stuff for it. There's a couple of things in Night Gallery that I think are among his best work, period. One called The Messiah on Mott Street. Which is about, it's a Christmas Hanukkah fable about an old Jewish man who just he's on his deathbed and he's trying to stay alive to take care of his grandson. And it's a really touching story. I think that's among the best things he ever wrote. He co-wrote the original Planet of the Apes. He wrote 7 Days in May, a terrific political thriller, the screenplay for that. He wrote these golden age of television shows we mentioned, like Patterns and Requiem for Heavyweight and other ones that people haven't heard of, like Rank and File I mentioned. So so there's all this stuff. It's an amazing body of work. And when you look at it just straight through, the magnitude of it is really impressive.
Well, you know, you mentioned Planet of the Apes. We actually had someone, his first name is Steve, emailed us and wanted to know a little bit more about Serling's work on Planet of the Apes. So he was the principal writer of that first segment? Series?
He was the first writer on board. I dedicate a chapter of the book to it because there has been a lot of misinformation about his work on that particular film. And he was the first writer who was hired, and he wrote several drafts of it, of the screenplay. And he was on the job, so to speak, for about 2.5 years. And there still hadn't been a producer. Well, it was a producer, Arthur Jacobs, but there hadn't been a studio who had, you know, agreed to finance the film. And they were not real satisfied with Serling's final draft. And one of the issues was that they were going to have to change the setting. They were going to have to change the setting to make it a pre-industrial setting, so they wouldn't have to deal with putting apes in a city, you know, in buildings and dressing them in suits and things like that, which is what Serling's original draft had. So at that point, you can imagine it. But yeah. You know, there was actually a graphic novel that came out just recently that was based on Serling's draft, and it's really interesting because you could really get a good idea of what Serling's version of the script would have looked like. But they got, you know, another writer, Michael Wilson, who came in, and he basically took Serling's draft and followed the structure and kept a lot of the imagery and a lot of the plot points, but basically rewrote almost all of the dialogue. So in that final film, almost none of Rod Serling's dialogue survived, but much of the Serling imprint is still there in that list. And he did write the ending. So that's beyond a doubt. He wrote the ending.
Okay. And we don't have a lot of time left, but what... You know, what beyond these things that we've already talked about do people not know about Rod Serling? And maybe that you mentioned the Antioch material, but you came across caches of materials that maybe other people haven't taken seriously.
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the things I mentioned in one of the appendixes, actually, of the book is that one of the impressive things is that not only did he write 250 scripts that were produced on television or a feature film, but he left behind dozens of completed screenplays and teleplays that weren't produced. It's just mind-boggling how anybody could have written this much in one short lifetime. Yeah. 25 years, essentially, he wrote all this stuff. So the one I'll give you before we run out of time is It's a Good Life. He wrote a feature-length version of It's a Good Life, the Twilight Zone episode. That's terrific.
Okay, I misread the clock. I'm over time. Thank you, Nicholas Parisi and John Keyswetter.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.